If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you. We have a great show for you today. We are going to be talking to journalists Yasha Levine and Mark Ames about the failed mutiny kicked off by the Wagner Group that has already been kind of resolved. We're going to get into that, what it means, what it meant, what the current state of affairs there is now, and it's changing every second. So we'll try to keep you as updated as possible. It's going to be a great discussion, especially because Yasha Levine is himself Russian-American and Mark Ames spent 13 years living in Moscow on and off. But before we talk about the war, the proxy war in Ukraine, we're going to be talking about a war here, right here at home, a war on free speech and political dissent. We're going to be talking to members of the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party. People probably know because we've covered this before, but they've been charged with sowing discord and weaponizing free speech, and they've been accused of being Russian agents. And we had Omali Yeshitela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, on last year after his home and organization's offices were violently raided by the FBI. We're going to be talking to him and his co-defendant and a lawyer who's representing his co-defendant. But before we do that, I actually had spoken about this case with Glenn Greenwald. So I did a pre-taped interview with Glenn Greenwald, and it's about the life and legacy of his late husband, David Miranda, and an institute that they're forming for him. And it's a really important, moving interview about this really magical person that was his late husband, David. But because I know that Glenn cares so much about this issue, I took a couple of minutes of his time to ask him to talk about the case against the African People's Socialist Party. So first, we're going to hear this short video from Glenn, and then we're going to go back and talk to Chairman Omali Yeshitela, Penny Hess, and Leonard Goodman.
This indictment shows how easy it is to criminalize dissent. That's really what this is about. They don't think these people are Russian agents or working or taking orders from the Kremlin. It's actually very insulting, isn't it? Kind of patronizing to tell these black leftists they have no mind of their own. They're just like robots being led around on a string by the Kremlin. These are people who are against the war in Ukraine, who believe a lot of the claims that are being fed by neocons and the U.S. security state about Ukraine are lies. That does happen to align with the Russian government, but it doesn't make them agents of the Russian government. And yet they're now being charged with multiple felonies that can send them to prison for a long time based on extremely dubious attempts to draw a connection between the two.
Yeah, and they're even admitting, the Justice Department is admitting that this is a free speech issue. It's just that they're weaponizing free speech. So they have to, I mean, I was actually surprised that they kind of copped to it, that this is an issue of free speech, but they had to pretend that, I guess, because it's being weaponized, you're allowed to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a gigantic First Amendment case here.
Doesn't that go against the Constitution? So that is Glenn Greenwald weighing in a little bit on this case. And this is a case that he himself has covered. And as you saw from that, we think it's a major First Amendment issue. So we're going to get into that and more with our guests. So we are going to bring back onto the virtual stage Chairman Amalia Yeshitela, who leads the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement. He's organized for Black Power for over 50 years, beginning with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, registering Black people to vote in the 60s. He has traveled the world building the movement for African unification and liberation, establishing relations of solidarity with anti-colonial struggles. We're also bringing on Penny Hess, who is chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, which she has led since its founding in 1976. She's built an international movement for reparations from the white community, working under the leadership and at the behest of the APSP. She's the author of the book, Overturning the Culture of Violence, and another of the Uhuru Three facing federal charges. And we're bringing on Leonard Goodman, a criminal law attorney based in Chicago, who is representing Penny Hess. He has won high-profile and precedent-setting cases, including in the U.S. Supreme Court and the Illinois Supreme Court. He is a published columnist and teaches federal criminal law at DePaul University. So, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to start off just by asking you, Chairman Yeshitela, can you just clarify what the relationship between the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement is?
Well, in some ways, the Uhuru Movement is actually older than the African People's Socialist Party. As you mentioned in the lead, Anne, that I was a SNCC organizer in the 1960s. And in fact, I went to prison as a SNCC organizer, a free speech issue there as well, connected to the removal of an 8x10 mural, a hostile mural, a racist mural, in the City Hall of St. Petersburg, Florida. And the SNCC was coming under extreme pressure also. They were being arrested on bogus charges, framed up and things like that. One time they were accused of, in Philadelphia, of someone the police claimed to have used some kind of mechanism that they can see through packages, and that there was some dynamite carried into the office. Not that any dynamite was ever used or anything. SNCC was the organization that initiated in the anti-war movement, Hell No, We Won't Go, and made the declaration Black Power. And so SNCC, you know, came under extreme pressure by the United States government as well. Some people you're familiar with, like Stokely Carmichael and H.R.I. Brown, et cetera, from that era. And then because of when SNCC came under fire and other organizations similarly were coming under fire, I, while in prison during the on the mural charge, came up with the idea of building an organization that would unite, all of these militant organizations, these anti-colonial organizations, the one that was called the Hunter of Militant Organization, the acronym JOMO. And so JOMO created the Burning Spear newspaper. And then following that, JOMO had the same characteristics as the Black Panther Party in many ways. And then following that, seeing the limitation of just having a protest movement, recognizing the need to be able to organize for political power, capturing and wielding political power, we created a party, the African People's Socialist Party. And the African People's Socialist Party came about as a consequence of many of the groups and forces that we were working with and influencing, building JOMO. And there were these white people who actually seemed able and willing to unite with the struggle of Black people in a real meaningful kind of way. Not in some kind of opportunistic way that was about building themselves, as what we had been accustomed to. And we had a conference in St. Petersburg, Florida in 1976, and built the African People's Solidarity Committee. It became a part of the Uhuru movement in the sense that it was influenced by the same politic, and also it was under the direct leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. So the Uhuru movement and various other institutions we've created since then, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. So there are a lot of these entities, institutions that are characterized as the Uhuru Movement, some with a direct organizational relationship and some not, but having more or less the same general belief system and self-determination for Black people.
And Penny, how did you guys meet? you and Chairman Yoshizawa?
Well, in 1976, so that was a long time ago, the Chairman Omali Yoshizawa was on a kind of tour, and I was living at that time in Louisville, Kentucky, and the chairman was giving an event there, and members of the African People's Socialist Party, and I did go to that with a friend of mine, and the chairman announced that they were getting ready to build a solidarity committee, a committee for white people under the leadership of the African Revolutionary Movement, and to work in the white communities. So I, you know, I went to a conference that they held in St. Petersburg, Florida, a few months later, and that was the foundation of APSC. And I have done this work in Brooklyn, actually, and where the African People's Socialist Party held the first tribunal on reparations to African people in 1982. It was very, very amazing. And also lived in Oakland, California, and St. Petersburg, Florida. Now I live in here in St. Louis, but all as part of building and organizing for white reparations to Africa.
And what about you, Leonard? How did you meet these people?
You know, I have heard Chairman Omali for years, and so I was familiar with him. I was not really familiar with the party, but I got connected through some journalism friends when they were looking for attorneys. I did follow the story of the raid this last summer on their headquarters and got involved shortly after that. And, you know, I'm proud to be part of this team and to defend these folks. And I think the government has picked on the wrong people because they're tough and they're ethical. You know, there's really, they believe what they're saying. You know, the allegation that they're Russian agents is so laughable to people that are their supporters, that know that they've held the same views and they're so consistent and so principled in their views for 30, 40 years.
So Chairman Omali, can you just, in case people are new to this story, set up, trace how this kind of prosecution and persecution started? You can start with the FBI's violent raid against your home and organization, to where we are today.
Well, the striking thing about it, the notification that we were, there's a new development in just a casual, ubiquitous FBI intervention in our organization, our lives, was on July 29th of 2022 at 5 o'clock in the morning. My wife and I were sitting in St. Louis, around a table preparing for the day. And she was coming to our office in St. Louis, where we were initiating a doula program for African women. St. Louis has a situation where there are something like enough African babies die in the first year of life to fill 15 kindergarten classes. And so we had this doula program that we were working with, and I was actually preparing to go to the gym. We were just sitting around talking. And then out of the dark, this booming command came to us. Hey, people who are in this residence, come out with your hands up. This is the FBI. And then grenades, this booming sounds, explosions started to go off all around the house. And it was startling. At first, we weren't sure what we were hearing because one of the things that we've sort of beginning to get accustomed to was these alerts that tornadoes are coming. And so you might hear these sounds warning. And so we were wondering if that's what we're hearing. And then it became clear that this is the FBI. And I tried to be the first to go downstairs, ask my wife to call and let people know we were being raided. And so she stayed up for a few minutes and I went downstairs. I didn't know at the time that they had jammed our phones, so we couldn't communicate with anybody. So I went downstairs. It's pre-dawn. And when I got to the bottom of the stairs, opened the door, I was greeted by the sight of these military forces in camouflage uniforms and standing in front of an armored vehicle. And I was, and these laser targeting device bouncing off my chest, these laser sightings, you know, those things you see in the movie. And of course, you know, I had to remember Fred Hampton at 4 o'clock in the morning in Chicago, where they had come in and murdered him and murdered Mark Clark, who was there with him. And so I assumed they were going to kill me. That's what I thought. I thought they were going to kill me coming downstairs. And so I followed the sound and the commands, and my wife following me, she comes downstairs and she's greeted and almost hit in the head by a drone that goes up into the stairwell. The explosions are still going off. These military forces are also on the porch of the neighbors next door. And so I get downstairs. I'm zip tied behind my back. My wife, when she gets downstairs, she's handcuffed behind her back. And trying to find out what happens, they tell me one thing: this is going to be in the news. This is going to be in the news, and that there's an indictment that's being made of a Russian national later this morning, and you've been named. And so we have a search warrant, and I asked to see the search warrant, and they indicated they didn't have it right there, but it was somewhere in the vicinity, et cetera. They couldn't tell me anything really because the indictment was going to be later that day. So finally, they said I could sit on the curb, and my wife, we could sit on the curb, or just, you know, humiliating kinds of suggestions that they made. So finally, just we didn't sit on the curb. So finally, just insistently asking, you know, if we were under arrest, can we leave? And they finally said, yes, we could leave. So then they had to cut the zip ties off me, which is very difficult for them to do. And they took the handcuffs from my wife, and we got in my car and left. And after one of them went upstairs to get the keys for my car, and we left. And when we left, we discovered that they were doing the same thing at our Solidarity headquarters on the south side of St. Louis. And then we learned that they had assaulted my house in St. Petersburg, Florida, because that's where I had lived. Nobody was there, but you see the videos, you see that there's scores of agents who occupied the house. They held us at gunpoint. They took our cell phones. They took any kinds of electronic devices and things like that. And then they went to the home in St. Louis of Penny Hess and others. And so a similar kind of thing happened to them. And in St. Petersburg, Florida, they tricked a young woman out of the house by claiming that somebody was breaking into her car and she needed to come out and take a look. And she gets outside, then FBI agents come from around these vans and what have you. And they do the same kind of harassing thing to her, take cell phones and you know, these charges, you know, then we learn about the charges. They occupied our residence and places for hours. And it was hours before I would come back to my house, and found on the table then a search warrant, and you know, stating you know, that they were looking for certain things associated with this charge that they were making against a Russian national. So that's what happened. And on April 18th, they said that we were unindicted co-conspirators and some plot under the leadership of Russia, that we were functioning as agents of Russia. And and then on April 18th, I think it was, some 9 months later, they actually indicted us. And on May 2nd, Penny and I, and May 8th, the third person, actually came to Tampa, Florida, where we were handcuffed, put in leg irons, stuffed in cells, and then brought before a judge and given what they characterized as a signature bond of $25,000, and placed, our passports were taken, and we have to get permission to go any place and at will, an agent of the United States government can come to our homes. And we haven't been convicted of anything. It's like we're on parole. And anything that we do that the parole officer, if you will, or the agent is displeased with can result in the revocation of the bond and could be jailed then. And otherwise, we're set to go to trial on these charges. And Attorney Goodman can talk more about that kind of stuff. And we're set to go to trial. And I think with the maximum sentence, if I'm not mistaken, of some 15 years, which is like a life sentence for me, you know. Yeah.
Because you're how old?
81.
81, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you explain to us, Leonard, how this is possible? What they're, first of all, what they're being charged with and accused of, and how you can possibly accuse someone of weaponizing free speech. I thought that was something that was protected under the First Amendment.
I thought so too, really, Katie. And they're charged under a pretty obscure statute. It's 18 USC 951. It's actually a companion to the Espionage Act. So it dates way back. It's rarely used. It's designed to go after secret spies, operatives of a foreign nation in this country. This is the first time it's been used directly to target dissenting speech and political speech. And it is true, the Supreme Court, there's a number of very good decisions back when the Supreme Court really did weigh in and care about these issues of free speech. But these are precedent say political speech is the core of the First Amendment. So I'm sorry about the dogs. What you're saying is correct. I mean, the use of a criminal statute to criminalize political speech and assembly, which is also part of their movement, is unprecedented, really. And it is certainly going to be an issue in this case.
And what is it that they are objecting to that you actually did do?
You know, Glenn was pretty much spot on. I mean, it really is their objection to the war in Ukraine. Most of the overt acts in the indictment are targeted at free speech, organizing that they did, protesting, U.S. involvement, and the crazy thing, and the government certainly has to know this, is that their opposition goes back to before they ever met with any Russians. I mean, the fact that Omaly participated in a conference in Moscow in 2015 had no impact on their opposition to the war. I mean, you can look at their positions. They have a newspaper and a website, the Burning Spear paper, and you can go back and see articles. I mean, they were against the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders. They were against U.S. involvement in the coup in 2014 that overthrew the democratically elected president of Ukraine. So their position on this is quite clear. And I have to imagine that the government knows that. So how they can make the allegation that they suddenly became Russian operatives in 2015 when the chairman was invited to participate in a conference is it's really shockingly weak, this case, and very dangerous as well. And I'll just correct one thing the chairman said. I think the maximum sentence is 10 years. And but, you know, we certainly are... We are going to win this case. There's no question in my mind, and these folks are never going to back down. And the chairman is a healthy guy. He's going to live more than 10 years, I can tell you. But he doesn't look his age, and he's a vigorous guy. But he shouldn't serve a day. And seeing them on the day that they were granted bond, being brought into the courtroom in chains was really quite distressing. Anyway, there's some very good lawyers on this case, and we're going to fight along with these brave activists.
Well, since we're talking about what it is that you apparently got into so much trouble for, do you want to lay out your view of what's happening right now in Ukraine, a view that, as Leonard just pointed out, is something you've held for, I would say, decades?
Well, if you look at Ukraine, our view is a worldview. It's not just some specific thing that's happening with Russia and Ukraine. We have a theory about the existing social system itself and how it came into being. And that the whole capitalist system is born, rests on a pedestal of colonialism, colonial domination by what is now characterized as Western powers. And that this thing is fracturing in a very serious way, that there's the obvious distress and the whole world and political and economic social system is undergoing a tremendous transformation. The world, economic and political configuration of the world is going in an incredible transformation. And what happened, of course, in 1917 with the Russian Revolution, that's when the assault on Russia began first. And all the colonial powers, including the United States and Japan, invaded Russia. And the objective then, because Russia, I don't want to go into all of that history, but it invaded Russia. And subsequent to that time, the foreign policy of the United States and Europe, Western Europe, has been to isolate, contain Russia in the various iterations that the Russian government has represented itself in, first, you know, with the Soviet Union, and later on Russia. And then, of course, you know, in 2014, this creeping movement by the United States to the borders of the Russia's borders. They had already done Afghanistan, that Brzezinski bragged about, the national security advisor for James Earl Carter had bragged about, contributing to the destruction of the Soviet Union, this Afghanistan thing that they had begun, you know, some years ago. I think it was 84. They may have gone into Afghanistan. And and so this whole process of moving closer and closer to Russian borders, encircling Russia, that has been obviously a part of the foreign policy of the United States. And it resulted in about 2014, the coup that was backed by the United States that overthrew an elected government, and that was friendlier to Russia than the so-called Western powers would have it to be. And so they initiated this coup. There's Zelensky government as a consequence of that, and involved in this government. I mean, you know, for people who proclaim to be concerned about such things as fascism and Nazis, et cetera, I mean, they're a critical component of the military forces in Ukraine. Not the majority, but critical sector. And so Zelensky is greeted as this great hero, and trillions, certainly scores of billions of dollars of U.S. money, weaponry, training forces, all kinds of resources going into Ukraine. And so suddenly we see that this love affair that's happening between the United States and Ukraine is moving against Russia. And it's not that we are Russians or anything like that, but we know something about the nature of the social system, and we can see this fracturing that's occurring here. And we know that this war is something that strengthens oppression and not help oppressed people anywhere in the world to be free. It strengthens a really incredible kind of reactionary situation on a global level. And so we had to oppose it and say we oppose, and say also we know why it's happening. And it's not like we're going to send troops to fight, in Ukraine or something, but we oppose it. And to say this is what is happening, that everything they're saying is a lie. And then billions and billions of dollars that they can't spend for education. They can't spend even giving people minimum kind of insurance or health care, et cetera. These billions of dollars that's being used to make this war and thousands of people are dying as a consequence of that. We can't say something about it. We can't go along with that just because we're here. So we protest that. We say that we don't agree with that. And let's tell the truth. And when you open up every door for the truth to be told, let's open this door. Let the truth be told. I mean, when I was younger, there used to be this saying in the United States, you go to school that free speech is just critical. And the United States believes in free speech because this battle of ideas, let the ideas, contest with each other. But you don't hear that anymore. Now you hear things like people being radicalized when they see the wrong things on social media, weaponizing free speech, et cetera. There's everybody's being listened to. Everybody. There's no such thing as privacy, a presumption of privacy in the lives of the people anymore. I don't think people expect privacy in this country anymore. I mean, it's so pervasive, this intervention in the lives of the people by a government that's everywhere. And it's not just something that so-called leftists are being affected by, but people across the political spectrum, in many ways, are responding to this intervention by the government that attacks the right people to think things differently and to act different and to create this special force that now has been designated by law, even as a protected class who carry guns in our communities and can raid our homes and things like that. That's an extraordinary kind of situation. And to sit and watch that happen and not protest it is begging to live under the worst kind of oppression. And Black people have come through it, live with it every day. And I'm damned if I'm going to be silent in the face of that.
So that's the criminal speech, apparently.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And could I just add, I think we should all be frightened about this type of prosecution, and it has nothing to do with agreeing with the chairman's views or not. I mean, right or wrong, the First Amendment, what's the saying? I mean, it's the marketplace of ideas. If you think he's wrong, then you should debate him, not put him in a prison. And, I think.
I agree, and I think that's I think it's a statement of inability to win a debate ideologically and politically. They would come with guns and lock people up in prisons and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes.
And Penny, why do you think they're going after all of you?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I just want to say, first of all, that I have worked under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party for over 40 years. And I have learned everything that I know and understand about the world from Chairman Omali Yeshitawa, and that turns history and the reality right side up and puts all of those on whose backs we sit as the leadership of towards winning a new world and overturning this very vicious system that we live in. So that's very enlightening. I just want to say that, but I think I would say two things. One, that they have always done this to African people who stand up for political and economic power in their own hands, such as Marcus Garvey, such as Paul Robeson, such as, just going all back, even before the 1960s, before Malcolm X, before what they did to Fred Hampton at 4 o'clock in the morning, and all of the COINTELPRO and the FBI murders and assassinations of the 60s, even before that, they were attacking, imprisoning, destroying movements for power. Like the chairman, says, there are different tendencies within the African movement. So I think that's one thing. And I think also that our job is going into the white community to organize other white people, for reparations based on, not based on a payoff or charity or anything like that, but based on, this is what's owed. This is stolen labor, stolen resources, stolen from African people who themselves were stolen. And this land is stolen from the indigenous people and genocide carried out against them. And, you know, all around the world is the plunder of Africa, of Asia, the Middle East, all of this that has brought the resources to the colonizers, which is the society that we live in. So that is our job. And I think that part of what they wanted to do was attack the leadership of the African Liberation Movement and try to attack white solidarity. You know, with it, they attacked the Solidarity Center, which is a building, as the chairman said, owned by the African People's Socialist Party that we use on the south side of St. Louis in a very prominent spot that can be seen with a banner that says unity through reparations, which so many, many white people, you know, that we do outreach, we do door to door, we do tabling at the farmer's market in the park and all that kind of thing. And so many people express just deep unity with that banner, with this, you know, with the work that we represent in this city where Mike Brown was murdered by the police and there was uprising and so many other atrocities perpetrated against the African community here. So, you know, this, I think that they have tried to intimidate white people, but in fact, we're growing, we're building, and this whole leadership of the chairman and there's the Uhuru Solidarity Center. All right. That's a great picture. And so, so this whole hands off Uhuru movement that Chairman Omali Yeshitela has formed and chaired by Mwezi Odom, who's just a dynamic force from the party as well. And we're just winning, like the chairman is saying, across the political spectrum, even across the board from so many organizations and individuals. Millions of people literally have seen the chairman on Democracy Now! And even on Fox News Channel. I think, what is that, like a million people on the original press conference, and just, you know, just comment after comment. People have donated, which people can do at handsoffuhuru.org/donate, but, you know, just raised a significant amount of resources, over $277,000 or something like that, $1,000. And well, there's more because lawyers are very expensive. And so, yeah, so this, it has been an outpouring of profound support. And I think that a lot of people in the white community, you know about what this government has done to African people and want to rectify that, want to have an honest relationship. And that's reparations. That's the essence of what that means.
So may I say something, Katie, please? Sure. Just two things. One, we didn't do what they said we did. So we are not guilty of what they said we did. That's one thing. And the issue of free speech is real question. But what they've contrived something, they've created, they've fabricated a narrative. It's like creating a disease or something. And or I've heard they created so-called medicine and created a disease to meet, you know, the requirements of the market for the medicine. So I think I just want to say that we didn't do it. That's one. And secondly, I think one of the things that made this attack on us something they felt they had to do is because for the first time in history, what the African People's Socialist Party has done, the Uhuru movement, is fracture the absolute solidarity of the white community with the attacks and aggressions against Black people. And there's probably a better way to say this, because obviously the solidarity movement could not exist if the unity was absolute. But there has been no avenue through which, there's been no vehicle through which white people have had this kind of opportunity to express their unity with Black people in opposition to what happens to African people here and around the world, and to take that to the African community. most of the people calling themselves white leftists want to come to my community. But we don't need you in my community. This, the problem is not here. The problem is over there. And so to have these forces who are working in the white community, and you know, the solidarity movement is in at least 140 some odd cities in this country. And Penny says that the issue is talking about reparation. Yes, it talks about reparation, but it talks about reparation in the context of talking about the struggle of Black people for our power, for self-determination, to move away from this notion of African people having to be welfare slaves, even what you call it, freedom, and the whole people live as welfare slaves, self-determination. There's no dignity in being a welfare slave. There's people have to be able to have advantage to the resources that we've created in the world, and the ability to exercise our capacity to feed, clothe, and house ourselves, and to create our own and future and define, you know, our future. So that's, I think this thing is actually like part of the Achilles heel of this whole system that people refer to as racism, et cetera. We crashed that. Now you don't have that absolute solidarity of white people just, and we don't demand that white people love Black people. We don't demand that white people like reggae music and do all this other kind of stuff, you know, because that's got nothing to do with the issue of colonialism. And even reactionary white person can be an anti-colonizer, can be against colonialism, can be for the right of Black people to have self-determination, to have to be self-reliant. Even the most reactionary white people can believe in that. And so, there's going to be a big disagreement on so many, many other questions, but that's something that I think many people have the ability to unite with.
So really quickly, because we have to wrap, I just wanted to highlight one question comment here. John McCarthy says, why have no presidential candidates spoken against this prosecution? Why aren't they challenged to every India media interviews, any of them? Every time indie media interviews any of them. Okay, so I'll make sure if I have more, I'll ask Cornel West about this. I should have asked him about it. But if I have any more, I'll ask them. And just really quickly, can you just update us on the arson event and the sanctions that you're facing?
Yeah, what has happened is right across the street from my house, the one that they attacked on July 29th, right across the street in the same place that the fire that the armored vehicles were located, their fire trucks there on December, I think it was it December 27th, December sometime, because the church, a big church, we have something like 50 or more economic development programs, and we had this church on the contract for where we were going to put other programs, and that church was mysteriously torched. I mean, an inferno right across the street from the house. We can't say the FBI did that. We can. But the fact is that obviously you didn't see them do it. And then banks where we were part of our movement has been involved in over many, many, many years, 20 or more years. We've never missed a payment. We've always paid on time and sometimes before time, et cetera. And they closed our accounts. They even closed Penny's personal account. And then they demanded that within a matter of several weeks that we give them a $70,000 mortgage. And so two banks have done something to that effect. And so they treat us like a foreign country, you know. The objective is to make sure that we fail, that we cannot, these programs that we put in the community. Because one thing about the programs is that if we can do this, if we can put a $160,000 basketball court in a community that looks worse than Ukraine in terms of being bombed out, if we can start creating these businesses and rehabilitating, why can't the government do that? And I think that becomes a contradiction for them as well. So it's not just that we disagree, but that we offer alternatives, real practical alternatives. And so we're under assault in so many ways, just like a government is.
Well, thank you so much. We'll put the links to your organization in the description. We also have a super chat from Quebec. Thank you, Claude. We have a bunch of people from all over, from Portugal, different countries and cities. So Irish Americans, Scottish Americans, Portugal. So thank you all so much for joining. We will keep updating the audience about your case. And yeah, make sure you come back.
Thank you. And thank Lynn. It's good to see you.
Yeah, thank you.
Attorney Goodman, this is a bad man. he's a hell of a lawyer. This is part of our dream team, so to speak, to coin a phrase.
Dream clients, too. Thank you, Katie.
Yes.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you guys so much. Okay, guys, that was great. Make sure you like the show. I forgot to do the usual announcements. Give a like, give a thumbs up. Also, if you can become Patreon supporters for just $1 a month, you get to make this show happen, be part of the show. It literally couldn't happen without your support. For $5 a month, you get basically like twice as much content. You get extended interviews. You get extra interviews. I have a great interview with Richard Wolf that's Patreon only. This thing that I did with Breonna Joy Gray is Patreon only. I have a short thing with Glenn Greenwald talking about free speech that's Patreon only. So many reasons. And if you're watching this live, you're in luck. You'll get to see this whole thing for free. If you're watching this later, part of this will be maybe Patreon only. And to access that, you go to patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And as Brad reminds you, please remember to hit the like button, share, and subscribe. Hit subscribe and then the bell. So we are moving on to our next segment. So excited to have these two guests coming onto the show. We are talking to none other than Yasha Levine, who is a Russian-American journalist, and also Mark Ames, a journalist who spent 13 years on and off in Russia, and also is the co-host of the Radio War Nerd podcast, which is a great podcast. And Yasha is also the co-host of the Russians podcast, another great podcast. So Yasha and Mark, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing, Katie?
Hey,
glad to be here. Look at you, Yasha.
Yeah.
So summer in San Francisco.
I'm
outside because I there's too much noise inside. So I got a little gas heater. You can't see it. It's just over there. And I got like two socks on.
Wow. You know, I'm in San Francisco, man. I always love that. It's all foggy and cool.
Yeah,
right?
that's so crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. It's pretty early here too. So yeah, good to be here.
Thank you. We wanted to have you on to talk about what is happening right now in Russia. There was obviously this Yevgeny Prigozhin tried to do a little mini mutiny, then that failed. That was on Friday.
I mean, 15,000 or 20, God knows how many.
Right, not mini mutiny, a mini coup, major mutiny or mini coup, right? Thank you for correcting me.
I'd say it was a, ride for justice is what I'd call it.
That's what we called it, right? Yeah.
It was the March for Justice, the Million Mercenary March for Justice, yeah. You mean since the mutiny / coup fell apart, or, Prigozhin, his forces, they made sort of two thrusts, one on Rostov-na-Don in the south, which is where a lot of the military command is for the main, for the war in Ukraine. And I think they were already heading that way, or they're very close by anyway. So it was easier to take that. And then another detachment, I think, again, we don't know a lot. But let's say it could have been a few hundred, vehicles worth of faster vehicles were heading up towards Moscow, and they were getting up there fast. I mean, you would see, they went through checkpoints in, Voronezh, and then through Lipetsk, and they got, I think, within 200 kilometers of Moscow. And it was sort of like this high stakes negotiation. It was a way of negotiating and getting Putin's attention because Prigozhin had been releasing increasingly wild, rage-filled, kind of increasingly crossing red lines videos on his Telegram channel. And, I think what that said was, everyone would say he's very close to Vladimir Putin. Well, if he was very close to him, he wouldn't be doing these videos for the public. I mean, he clearly Putin hadn't been picking up his calls for quite a while. And then apparently, according to the story, as his troops were getting closer, Putin tried calling him and couldn't get through. He basically said, I'm busy or something. And that really pissed off Putin. Then he panicked and tried calling Putin and couldn't get through to Putin. I don't know if this is true, but I like this story, even if it's not. And then Alexander Lukashenko, the leader of Belarus, came in as the, I think it's the first time Lukashenko has been able to do something where he looked like something more than just a Putin's cuck, like his puppet or something, you know, where he was able to take a manly role in all of this and to kind of assert himself a little bit. So he got on the horn with Prigozhin and Putin and helped defuse the situation. And apparently, again, we don't know the terms of the deal. Like, what we do know is it did defuse it, whatever the deal was. And we do know that Prigozhin is in Minsk, and there are some Wagner mercenaries or fighters, whatever you want to call them, that are in Belarus as well, but we don't know how many. I mean, is it like, what are you going to say, Yasha?
I don't know. They're in a specialized camp.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
like, I would like imagine right taking here, that gentlemen. Up. It's like, hey, yeah, we got a little camp for you right here. Yeah. Go to sleep. You know, don't worry. Yeah, I know you must be tired from that march. You know, I would not go to that
let
camp.
Me tuck you in.
Exactly. Well, you know, I want to comment on something. I mean, just, you know, I mean, I, because no one, okay, well, no one really knows what is actually going on or what is behind Prigozhin's march. I mean, we can only sort of make guesses, but I mean, I don't know what you think about this, Mark, but, you know, one thing that was surprising to me, you know, going and kind of listening to the 30-minute speech that he made, you know, that he released on Telegram, video speech, recorded speech, you know, basically a day before before he went on Rostov, he kind of made this ultimatum or something, or said his grievance speech, kind of like what Putin did with the war, right, in Ukraine.
Right.
He did his grievance speech, yeah. Waited a day, and then just, oh, okay, no one's saying anything? Oh, no, yeah. No one's coming to me? Okay, all right, I'm serious now. And then he went on Rostov. But if his intention was to get his bosses or get Putin's attention and kind of get in Putin's good graces and say, hey, Putin, like, you're not picking up the phone, and you got all these assholes who are, you know, above me, who are, you know, basically wrong, who are corrupt, who are doing everything wrong, and they're messing everything up for you. He didn't praise Putin. I don't remember.
No.
He didn't praise Putin at all.
No.
It was a very strange thing. Yeah.
It was. I mean, he was doing the sort of the Tsar's ministers are bad, but the Tsar is good thing up until that moment. And
he
then,
didn't say
it, but earlier he was.
Yeah.
He wasn't necessarily saying Putin is good, but he was making a, he was saying that Putin is being misled. Which is that sort of thing, right? And
yes,
but he did get more directly in Putin's face at the very end there.
Yeah.
We actually have a video I wanted you to react to, a short video from Reuters. Brad, do we have that?
Head of Russia's Wagner Group mercenary organization is for the first time publicly rejecting Moscow's official justification for the war in Ukraine, saying the reason for the invasion was based on lies, running directly counter to President Putin's own statements, and marking a new milestone in the months-long feud between the Wagner founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and Russia's top military brass. This is part of Prigozhin's video, which was posted on Telegram.
Why was the war needed? The war was needed so that a handful of scumbags could have a blast and get PR attention showing how strong the army is. The war was needed not in order to return Russian citizens to our bosom, and not in order to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. It was needed for one star with additional embroidery, so that one mentally sick man could look good on a coffin pillow. Shaigu lives by the principle that a lie must be horrific for people to believe it. That's when the lies come.
Prigozhin's referring to Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shaigu, a constant target of his criticism. He's often accused Shaigu and other military leaders of incompetence, but rejecting the core reasons for the war is new for Prigozhin. He says Shaigu's deceiving President Putin, and that the war was also used to enrich the ruling elite. Prigozhin also specifically uses the word war in the video. not the phrase special military operation used by the Kremlin. Prigozhin's enjoyed unusual freedom in publicly criticizing Moscow, although not Putin himself.
God, where do Reuters hire these people, man? This is like the most wild, exciting, horrible and everything, but this was the most exciting news event of for the last year. And that guy just put me to sleep. I mean, what the hell's wrong with him?
I mean, I find the translation.
He also left out like how really incendiary. It didn't sound nearly as incendiary as the original. Yeah. Right?
It feels like it's that was a mashup of two different clips because the middle translation seemed to come from somewhere else. More or less, it's correct. I mean, that's what he said. That's in fact the 30-minute speech that I'm referring to, in which he explicitly said that. I mean, one of the things that was interesting is that he said Russia was not under threat, that there was no threat of Ukraine invading Russia. One of the justifications that Russia gave for this invasion was that, you know, Ukraine was planning an imminent attack, an imminent invasion of Russia. And so this was done as a kind of preemptive attack to protect Russia.
Preemptive war.
Preemptive war. You know, we all know how well those go in America. So he says that was wrong. I mean, he says that one man basically launched this war, you know, Shoigu, which is Sergei Shoigu, who is the Minister of Defense of Russia, who he's been, you know, feuding with for openly for months now. And essentially,
he's thought to be a potential successor to Putin too, which is an important thing to note here. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's Putin's boy. I mean, pretty clearly. Yeah. And so he's been warring with him directly. And so he's sort of laying it at his feet saying, he's been lying to Putin. He's been lying to the Russian people about the nature of this war and the threat that, you know, Russia was under, which, you know, didn't exist essentially. And so it was pretty interesting. It was kind of like, he's kind of making, an observation that I guess I've made, you know, in the beginning of this, after this war started, you know, that this didn't seem like to be, I mean, this was a war of choice. This wasn't a war of necessity, you know, in the sense that like they chose to do this, not because they were defending themselves, you know, immediately, but because they thought there were other plans for it. And so it was pretty interesting to see him say, because at least, you know, not everything, I don't think it was one man launched the war. I don't think Shoigu is the guy who's, you know, masterminding the war. I don't know what you think, but I think that's, that's just part of his sort of, that's part of his feud.
Yeah.
But that other part about, you know, basically calling bullshit on the reasons for the war, you know, in his own little kind of limited way, I think is actually pretty true. You know, strikes me as at least 75% true. So it was surprising,
it was just useful for him at that moment to say truer things. What was he facing? Wagner did the hardest fighting of the war for Russia. I mean, probably certainly of any battle, and certainly of the last 8 months of the war, at least, which is the Battle of Bakhmut, and fulfilled a job, a really grim as hell job for Russia to fulfill a war aim. And essentially it was this. Last year, in the first, month of the war, and then, you know, and beyond that, far too many young Russian males were dying. And this threatened to make the war very unpopular. And what is one of the big uses of private military contractor mercenary groups like Blackwater and DynCorp and Wagner and so on? One of them, I mean, there are many uses of them, obviously. First, you know, people can stuff each other's pockets. You can do things more off books, half in, half out, plausible deniability. But a really big thing is that it changes the way people look at the war and casualties. Like, for example, I've been making this point lately. In the two major wars that the U.S. has fought in the last 20 years, Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, I saw a study recently on this. About 7,000, maybe slightly over 7,000 U.S. servicemen died, and over 8,000 private contractors for U.S. private contractors died. So that's 15,000, but we never see that number. And it's a different number than 7,000. You know, 7,000 is bad too. 15,000 is like, whoa. It's never counted along with it. And, you know, they're not real in American society, they're not officially really people. They're either people who, hey, it was your choice. You were there for the money. A lot of them are foreign nationals. We don't actually have the number because some of them are foreign nationals and the reporting is different, and that's by design. And so, and you know, Wagner did that sort of stuff for Russia, for some of its overseas ventures, both to make money and to spread influence and to fight more. So they, you know, they were deeply involved in Syria. They're involved in some conflicts in Africa. And when Wagner soldiers die, it's not a PR problem because Russians aren't outraged in the way that they would be or have been if it's servicemen. So, you know, as an example, so going fast forward, late last year when Prigozhin came out publicly, they were always playing this game, but he came out publicly last year and said, yes, I'm the leader of Wagner. And they started showing him giving speeches in prison yards, you know, these like Sparta 300 speeches and offering these people a chance to get out of prison, fight for Mother Russia. And what it wound up being was a way to attrit Ukrainian regulars using Russians who don't matter and don't contribute to the economy, that is convicts. So thousands and thousands of, you couldn't do this to the regular army, at least that mechanism hadn't been worked out yet. So you used Wagner for that. So Wagner, you know, became this fighting force. You know, again, we don't know how big it was, let's say anywhere from 5 to 10,000. It swelled up to 50 to 60,000. I'm throwing numbers again, going by different studies, making my best guess, of whom 40,000 were convicts. It's possible that at least 10,000 of those convicts died, 10 to 20,000, you know, wounded, missing in action. Some were taken POW, a lot of them deserted. But they killed a lot of Ukrainian regulars that Ukraine needs. That Ukraine needs to fight Russia, that Ukraine needs for its economy. And so it really was, in the really grim math of this war, a successful operation in Bakhmut to attrit Ukraine and to hollow them out somewhat before the big expected counteroffensive. And you've seen how the counteroffensive has not gone too well for Ukraine so far. You know, I'm not going to predict anything, but that is how it's gone so far. And once their job was done, And Prigozhin clearly had a sense this was going to happen, and so did his fighters. Once the job was done, they were going to be disposed of. And that's exactly what happened. I don't know when the first order came out or the rumblings of it, if it was a few weeks ago or even a bit earlier, that Wagner was going to be folded in, you know, by decree into the Ministry of Defense. And this is what he was rebelling against. And his videos were getting more and more hysterical. I mean, you go back to even May, late May, when he was posting videos also questioning the rationale for the war, saying, you know, the point of this war was to demilitarize Ukraine, quote unquote. And look what we did. We turned them into they're now, nobody knew Ukraine before. Now they are the Romans or the Greeks. They're as famous as the Romans or the Greeks. They had 20,000 good fighters in February 2022. Now they have 400,000. So we didn't demilitarize them, we militarized them. He's been saying this. He went to a new level, as Yasha pointed out. He definitely went to a new level. But he went to that new level last week after Putin officially came out with the Ministry of Defense, with Shoigu, and said, I'm putting my name behind this, that Wagner's done. And next, you know, by July 1st, everyone has to sign a new contract with the Ministry of Defense. And so he lost his business. And he, you know, he saw people die. He was right up there in the front. I mean, you saw, Yasha, that video of him with all those corpses. You know,
exactly. And it's interesting. He's taken a much more, for a guy who's been stayed in the shadows all these years, and you know, has denied that he has anything to do with the Wagner Group. I mean, he's gone completely, you know, personal, and is like, and it seems like he hasn't really left the front. You know, I mean, the videos are gruesome with him just walking around like a field strewn with corpses, and he's like almost like picking them up and like, look, this is our boys. You know. This is what Shoigu is doing.
It's almost unbelievable. Like, I've never seen anything like that before. He is quite a character. I'll give him that.
Yeah, he is. He's like a character that you're never, I mean, I don't think Russia is ever going to produce characters like this. I mean, these people were like four in the 90s, essentially, you know, and like,
yes.
And, you know, I mean, just to go from just like a petty criminal in the 80s, you know, in the Soviet Union to being this sort of like basically a hot dog salesman in this like really gnarly kind of outdoor market in this right in the center of St. Petersburg, kind of notorious for being, you know, this sort of like.
Oh, you know which market he was working in?
Oh yeah, it's famous. Aproxin Dvor. It's like it's right off of Nevsky Prospect.
Nevsky, okay.
It's still even today it hasn't fully like reconstructed, and it is still a market, you know. And it's
right.
I mean, so I can imagine in the '90s it must have been just a totally mobbed up.
I mean, Petersburg was the roughest town in Russia then, like way rougher than Moscow.
And from going from that to basically starting these pretty successful kind of like '90s style restaurants to the point where. You know, George Bush, when George Bush and Laura Bush came through, he made their tour of Russia in 2002. They were on one of his boats. They went to Prigozhin's restaurant boats.
I love that.
So you can actually see Prigozhin always hanging out in the background with Putin, Ludmila, you know, Laura Bush just kind of hanging out, being like the kind of the master, you know, of the ceremonies. He's just waiting on them, you know, to being a guy just running around the battlefield. Just completely insane, you know, like picking up dead bodies that are ripped to shreds. It's quite a trajectory, man. I think it did drive him crazy probably, you know, because he's, again, he seemed to have a grievance with Putin directly. I mean, he didn't state it, but the fact that he was so reserved about kind of praising him and in some kind of way, it showed me that he was pissed with Putin.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is Putin's response tell us? I mean, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is, you know, the walls are closing in. It's finally, basically, I feel like this becomes like a Rorschach test where everyone who wants Putin removed says this is proof that he's on his way out. Everyone who likes Putin says, oh, this is proof that he's strong because look at how he handled
it. I've seen people say stronger than ever.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about?
This is just his genius moves to like, you know, get the filth out of the military structure. Yeah, it's like his genius moves.
But what is it really?
And you tell me what you think, Yasha. I'm curious what you think. I'll tell you what I think.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.